Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom. And we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and PT pearls to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. Welcome back to another PT Pearl. So today we are diving into neuromuscular re-education. What that means, why it's important to you, and how it can even start to relate to the guest that we have today because she works with pediatrics.
Absolutely. And neuromuscular re-education is this fancy word just to say like how well our nervous system learns and can adapt based on the movements we're doing, specifically when we're talking about movement. I guess that's when physical therapists use it the most, is neuromuscular re-education of muscles or the nerves that go into the muscles. And we talk about this a lot in pediatrics because we see how the nervous system develops until we are a full-fledged adult, moving like, you know, our adult selves. We can see that perfectly in the average kid, and it's pretty predictable. So when we have injuries or things later in life, sometimes it can mimic what happens while we're developing in that time as kids, or even as we're aging, we'll notice some of the things reverting back to how they were when we were kids. So we're going to talk a little bit through that.
Yeah. And we want to keep it like really easy to understand. So when we talk about re-education in any sense, I love talking into neuro re-ed because especially when it comes to pediatrics, we learn so much from kids that we forget. And a huge reason for that is because we go from sitting crisscross applesauce on the floor, you know, learning in that kind of environment and playing and doing different things to all of a sudden we're sitting in desks all day long. We're sitting in cars. We're sitting, you know, we're just in a constant non-moving state within our bodies. And then we're expected to go lift heavy and go perform well or be weekend warriors and go win races when it's like, but I'm not training my body the way that I used to. So learning from kids again as we get older can be so beneficial in this.
Yeah. And I think that as we talk through some of the things, there's going to be some like eye openers for people as to, oh, wow, I didn't even realize that. Or, oh, wow, I didn't even realize that I was neglecting those types of movements or those types of things. Because especially when you think about a kid, when they're going through all this development, when they're exploring, when they're dropping down to the ground, when they're rolling around, when they're running and falling and laughing, they're moving so much and they're moving through all these positions a lot. Think about our average day, right? Just take a second if you're listening or watching and think through your day and how much we're moving. And if the majority of our day is spent in a sitting position and driving in a car, doing a certain type of work where we're in a certain position, and how much time we allot, even if it's for a minute or 30 seconds, to come back around to how we're positioning ourselves, putting ourselves in some different positions throughout the day so that our system doesn't start to adapt in a certain direction.
Yeah. And that's where it's so important. So let's just break down some of the fundamentals of how we move as children. And as we talk through them, like Dom said, think about it. Like, have you been doing it? Are you moving this way? Have you been neglecting it? And so one of the most basic patterns that we can think of when we look at a little baby, they're laying on their backs.
Yep. Laying on their backs, exploring with their hands and exploring their feet, grabbing their feet with their hands.
Well, not yet. I mean, when they're really, really little.
Yeah. Yeah. Not immediately.
Yeah. So when we're talking super, super early developmental stages, they're laid out though. Like, how does it feel to lay out with your arms open, with your legs straight almost or almost straight? Can you look side to side? You know, if we start to think about these different patterns, like obviously there's different specific patterns when it comes to neuro-re-ed that we need in children that we're not going to get super specific with because we don't normally lose those as we age. But just think about, can I even look side to side? Can I lay out or do I need a pillow under my knees? Like, what has my body been neglecting that it's not even able to lie supine anymore?
Totally. And I mean, we progress in being able to do different things in supine, like I mentioned, you know, grabbing our toes, putting our toes in our mouth. I'm not sure where that exactly crosses over with once we get prone and once we're able to be on our stomach. What, putting your toes in your mouth?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We won't put our toes in our mouth because But having that type of hip mobility opens up the opportunity to move so many different ways, like we're going to talk about next with crawling. But getting on your stomach is the next important one where you can kind of prop up, push up against gravity, you know, look that head around. So they go from laying on their back, laying on their stomach.
Yes. So laying on your stomach, also very important. Does your back have the extension? Like, we always think of core strength, right? And when we think of core strength, we're usually thinking of the front of the core. Mm-hmm. How strong are my abs? How well do my abs look? But we forget that the core wraps around to the back as well. And that's why, especially when we talk about babies, tummy time is so important, because getting them used to how they can lift their head and how they can start to explore and gain that strength, that's also core strength. So our core wraps around to our back, and understanding and getting, being able to lie on the belly and not just, usually when people lift onto their hands, we're not even moving from the upper back anymore.
Yeah.
When we push onto our hands, where our hips lift off the ground, we can't even keep the hip bones on the ground, and we hinge right where your low back meets your upper back, and we just end up moving over one area rather than getting this good fluid extension all throughout that spine.
I'm very guilty for that, because my upper back doesn't like to move as much, so I just crank it all through my lower back without realizing sometimes.
And that's why even starting on your elbows, like, can you lie on your stomach and just prop onto your elbows and kind of relax? Can you even just get your hands underneath your shoulders and just start to lift a little bit and stay on your forearms? Like, it doesn't have to be the extreme. That's where everyone likes to, oh, I can lay on my stomach and push up. But what does it feel like to come even lower? And that's when we can start to retrain, you know, that upper back extension and those different movements and strength patterns.
So then next, we move from transitioning from laying on our back to our stomach and rolling, or being able to roll side to side, right? Back to front. So we've mastered laying on the back. We've mastered laying on the front. Now rolling from our back to the front. And this is where we start to realize, like, that's something that's really common. If someone's had a neuro injury, like a stroke or something, one of the first things that we need to teach them is how to roll again, or how to, with our arms and legs working slightly differently, you know, find ways to do that pattern again. So again, it comes in big as physical therapists, depending on what settings we're working in, but being able to roll.
Yeah, rolling is so huge. Like, you don't think about it. And I'm not talking push with your hand and roll over. I am talking arms up, legs out. So arms up by your ears, like straight arms by your ears. And can you take one arm and wrap it around and then let the legs kind of just like dead fish over?
Yeah.
And, or can you take one leg and start to lift that leg and allow the body to kind of follow? And this is going to show you not only mobility in the shoulder, but mobility through the shoulder blade, through the spine, through the hips. And so it could be a mobility restriction that's restricting us from being able to kind of segment through the spine as we roll one way versus the other way. Mm-hmm. Or it could be a like more of a strength issue, weaknesses throughout the body. Or it could just be that neuro deficit where I haven't done rolling in so long.
Yeah.
I don't even know how to do it anymore.
Yeah, totally. I mean, rolling without pushing, get on the ground and try it. And it might surprise you, because sometimes if I haven't done it for a while, you get on the ground, you're like, oh my gosh, how does this work?
Yeah.
That's something you got to teach into the system again, because it's something that neuromuscularly, our brain basically just forgot that program.
Exactly.
And it's hidden and buried under years of sitting and driving in cars
exactly.
or something like that. And so when we start to revive and do that pattern again, I mean, some of the principles of neuromuscular reeducation are doing things repetitively, doing things consistently. Mm-hmm. And the more that you teach that in again, you retype in that program a little bit.
Yeah. And when it comes to rolling as well, you might notice that maybe you don't use your hand. You're like, okay, I can do it without my hand. But your whole body stiffens, and all of a sudden, the whole side wants to come all the way over. When your body comes into this natural like stiffness state, it's because, again, it doesn't have the mobility and the stability programmed in to allow it to do it naturally. So it kind of, oh, it gets really tight and stiff and tries to do it and force it for you. That's not a rolling pattern. Mm-mm. Like, you want to be able to take your arm and draw your whole body over with your legs relaxed. You want to be able to take one leg, and I'm talking back to front, front to back. That's how you get into better rolling. And I don't care if you're at the gym now doing this, like, do it. It's going to be really good for you.
Totally. And that's something that you'll notice in kids right away. Initially, they'll do this, like what you call more of an en bloc turn. And then as they learn how to segment that mm-hmm. movement, you'll notice how it becomes a little more natural. So after rolling, you might need to check me. Is it quadruped mm-hmm. that kids can, you know, yeah. one of the next
I
stages
mean, we can
you'll
go
work into?
Like, that's where now we're getting into like exploring the knees on the back, exploring yeah. the feet on the back.
Totally.
Because we have to be able to get into this full mobility even before we can get into a quadruped position. But yes, yeah. So gaining that mobility first and then going into quadruped.
Totally, which is hands and knees. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people might do exercises in this area. It's common for some different core exercises and core variations, different class work like Pilates or yoga positions can kind of be in this quadruped position. So it is something that might be trained into certain programming a little bit more than, say, just laying on your back or laying on your stomach.
Yeah. And I would say for this one too, it's not just being in a stiff hands and knees, but if you notice a baby, especially before they start to crawl, they go back and forth. They kind of like, they pounce back and forth because it's almost like they're getting ready to explore lat locomotion going forward. But when they're doing that, they're getting their hips into that good squat position without even thinking about it. They're kind of, their back stays straight and their butt kind of comes back and forward in that quadruped position. Now think about it. What does it look like when you do it? Does it look like a big rounded spine as you sit back towards your heels? Or can you have that hip mobility? Where is that hip mobility restricted? Where in the muscles might it be restricted? Just something to start, you know, becoming aware of. Like, yes, we're talking about neuro-rehab, but if you want to gain that stability in different patterns, you got to gain the mobility first.
Totally. And this is another thing, like we said, being aware, like how often am I getting down on my hands and my knees? Is it difficult to get down on my hands and my knees to play with my kid, to look under the refrigerator, to pick something up that I drop, whatever it may be. So where can you start to program this in? You know, is it having a mat in your office where you can get on the ground and do mm-hmm. some things on your back and do some things on your stomach and get on your hands and knees and get that body feeling different positions for 5 times, 3 or 4 times a day, like mm-hmm. or 5 minutes, 3 or 4 times a day. I mean, so where can we program that back in?
Oh, that'd be such a good idea. Can you imagine if every person at an office had a mat that they could just get down on?
Yeah. That'd be amazing, especially if all the desks came all the way down.
Oh, that'd be so good. And all the way up.
True. True. Someday. Someday.
Yeah. All right. Next, after kneeling. Quadruped, they crawl.
Crawling. Yep.
And how do they crawl?
I mean, we crawl opposites. So everything is kind of done in this opposite pattern because it's what kind of keeps us balanced around our midline. If we're trying to crawl or move or walk, by moving the same arm and leg at the same time, it's just such an unbalanced movement. So instead, we walk and we kind of rotate that core towards itself, you know, hip towards shoulder. So they crawl in the same way. They pull with one side, pull with the other side.
Mm-hmm. Without even thinking about it. That's just like a locomotive pattern that our brain knows how to develop into. So especially like start thinking about this. We're going to give you an exercise that I really love when it comes to repatterning this. But think about it with chronic pain. If you are only doing things like say you've had chronic pain in your back and you're only doing the intense stabilization that both sides are doing the same exact thing and you're not moving and you're doing anti-rotation, anti-flexion, all these things, right? But you're not getting back into opposite arm, opposite leg motion and you're staying super stiff, you're also telling your brain it is not safe to do that. And so that's where we talk about this neuromuscular repatterning. We want you to get back into this natural flow of what your body is used to doing when you were little.
Yeah, it's not about training things for strength or training things for how long you can hold it, or just it's about training it for function and what's actually going to help us in real life. And that's where when we show you the thing we're about to show you, sometimes we'll do that with people and it is like you're telling them to try writing their name with their left hand backwards because it's like, how do I coordinate these things? And if you've done it before, you might be like, oh, that's easy. Or if it's something you're used to, it might be, oh, that's easy. But again, if it's something you don't do regularly, just that getting back into that patterning, we got to type that program back in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So crawling, get on the floor and crawl.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely. Seriously, it's a really good, it feels good. It's a good workout. Yeah. And it's going to help to repattern you.
It's another thing that we put out sometimes is crawling stuff. Go look at like Venus's post. She has all this stuff on the ground.
Animal Flow.
Venus would be good to watch for this kind of stuff if you're looking for some examples of ground-based things you can try out. Mm-hmm. So then next, they'll get into kneeling.
Yes. So we go, and usually we're then go one leg and then the other, right? Which is such a beautiful stability position that we miss a lot. So what I see a lot is we do supine exercises, a lot in Pilates, right? We do maybe some prone type exercises, we do quadruped, and then we go to stand. Mm-hmm. And we miss this half kneeling position. It can be so beneficial for learning how to move this upper body with a more stable one foot in front of the other base.
Yeah. And kneeling, I love because it's kind of that intermediary. Like you said, people ignore it, but how can we be functional if we don't know how we get from one position to the next? Mm-hmm. And if we don't know how to get from the ground to standing up? Again, mm-hmm. something that later in life or in our later stages of life, we might start to lose that ability to get down to the ground and back up. And that's something that starts to be like, okay, do we need somebody around to help take care of you?
Yeah.
And so really training in that kneeling position is going to help us get from all fours, kneeling, you know, one leg forward and then standing up. So, mm-hmm. and also it's another thing that gets you working in that kind of diagonal pattern. We talk a lot about this diagonal pattern and coiling shoulder towards the opposite knee when that knee's forward. And so if you're kneeling, you can do a lot kind of in that diagonal pattern that helps train that good coil and power through our core.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it's like your baseline of balance. So think of standing both feet or one foot in front of the other. If you want to start standing one foot in front of the other and actually work on balance type stuff, do kneeling, half kneeling, one leg back, one leg forward. That's also like automatically people start to do that and kind of lose balance. Like this is a way to start to work on balance, and more so from like what Dom was saying, that core area where we think of our traditional trunk from our shoulders to our pelvis and kind of getting that to work and stabilize. So it's super good.
So when you're in that half kneel, I guess the next position would be bringing one other knee forward.
Yeah.
And this is what a kid can do easier because their center of mass is so much lower to the ground. So they're not, they don't feel as unsteady, especially because kids' heads are so big.
Exactly. So put a plate on top of your head and then squat down. I think Pat Davison showed that one.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot easier.
But kids will just sit down in these full squats and play even before mm-hmm. they can get into that full, you know, standing position, because then they become so top heavy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so that's where, again, are you even squatting? Like a lot of people avoid it at all costs. We'll start to bend from the back. We'll do whatever we can. We'll do one foot in front of the other. We'll do whatever we can to kind of avoid that deep squat position. And I'm going to say, stop avoiding it so much. It's restrictive for a reason.
Yeah. And toilets are always going to be 17 inches in public bathrooms. So I'm just kidding. There'll be some toilets that'll be higher. But again, it's the things that are important late in life. And are we going to be able to continue to do those things? And if we encounter situations like that out in the public, are we independent in getting down and up, or do we have pain when we have to do it? Do we have to significantly modify something to do it? Mm-hmm. You know, and it tends to become those modifications that might result in different pains.
Exactly.
When we are compensating just to squat or just to get back to a toilet or just to get to our kitchen table, you know, chair.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But even then, when a kid starts standing, they use the strategy of extension, a full extension in their back and their shoulder blades and their hands high, and we call it high guard. And that's what they kind of use to keep themselves upright right away while they're starting to explore those feet. And it's more than anything to have their hands ready to catch the ground when they fall. But I like to point that out because, again, as they get more used to it, then they lower their guard, their hands come down towards their hips rather than up by their shoulders and face, and they start to do that opposite pattern with walking, mm-hmm. opposite arm, opposite leg. Similarly, as people get older and they get a little unsteady on surfaces, our hands come up, mm-hmm. we re-engage in this high guard position with our shoulder blades engaged, with our back tight.
Everything's
kind of like you said, everything stiffens up. And that's a protective and guarding mechanism to tell us that, oh, we don't feel comfortable walking normally anymore, I guess.
Exactly. And I love like we're touching on that, how a kid starts to explore standing as well. They weight shift side to side. And that's a balance thing that we start to lose as well. So are you even standing on one leg? Can you? And this is why I like, so it's called frontal plane type movements when you move side to side. So lateral lunges, think about lunging to the side or just holding a weight like a goblet position and then opening your legs wide and then going side to side, right? And kind of letting one, your weight fall to one leg and do a side squat and then letting your weight fall to the other leg and doing it like a single leg side squat. But even just developing back into these patterns that, again, we neglect and getting back into weight shift on side to side and getting the body used to that again. It's like, what have you been neglecting? And we want you to listen to this podcast and just like, what have I been neglecting? What am I not adding in?
Yeah. And this is where the process that we basically just described from laying on your back all the way to, you know, walking or doing higher level things, walking, that's the neuromuscular development or the neurodevelopment, right? The neuromuscular re-education comes in when we start forgetting those things, right? So we have done these things probably at some point in life, you know, if you had more or less a quote normal, you know, development as a kid. But when was it that we started doing things in a certain way, neglecting certain movement patterns and developing different patterns in our body that kind of overwrote these initial motor patterns that our body wrote during our initial development? And so how do we get back to those, start putting those back in so that we can reteach them or re-educate in them?
So we're going to go over just a couple exercises that I like to do to, again, repattern that brain in that re-education like you talked about and getting opposite arm, opposite leg. So kind of favoring what the brain already knows, going back to those developmental milestones and how we can start to do a dead bug that isn't just the dead bug you think about. So usually when people think about dead bug, it's just arms and legs up to the ceiling and then opposite arm, opposite leg, which usually people can't really do very well anyways. And they end up doing the max progression where really we should start at a little bit lower and be using the breath with it. So we're going to go over that really quickly. If you want to see it, head over to YouTube at DocGenFit and it will be there for you to see visually. Okay, so we're going to take you through three different dead bug positions. So if you're listening, try to tune in, listen to what I'm saying. And then we're going to go into a bridge type pattern that, again, is really good. Now, what you want to be focusing on throughout this entire time, rather than just the exercise, you want to be focusing on the breath. So what I would be cueing Dom into is really thinking of a, almost thinking like a 2 to 4 seconds in, 2 second hold, 2 to 4 seconds out, 2 second hold. And he can even do this with the movement of his arms and legs as well. So if he wants to take a move with the arm and leg, take a 2 second inhale, hold it for 2 seconds, and then move with the arm and leg, 2 second exhale, hold. And this box breathing not only gets you focused on what the breath is doing and kind of rebalancing that inhale and exhale, but it's also then utilizing that breath with the opposite arm, opposite leg, that patterning. So again, we're just getting a lot of neuro re-education here. Okay, you ready?
Ready to roll. Let's do this.
So the first one, if you can imagine, Dom is lying on his back. His elbows are by his side and his arms are bent to 90 degrees. So his fingertips are up to the ceiling. His legs are bent with feet on the floor. Okay. So it's almost, it's a very, what you would think is really fundamental core here. Okay. Because the feet are on the ground. They're not up in tabletop position and the elbows are actually bent by the side. Okay. Now what he's going to do is he's going to lift the one leg up to a tabletop type position, meaning knee over hip, and then the elbow comes right over the shoulder. And then he comes right back down with that opposite arm, opposite leg, and then again, and switch. So knee directly over hip, elbow over shoulder. So 2 second inhale, 2 second hold, 2 second exhale, 2 second hold. 2 second inhale, 2 second hold, 2 second exhale, 2 second hold. Obviously, it doesn't have to be that breath pattern, but again, it's just a good way to start to reintroduce, especially if you're used to having back pain, if you're not used to these core type exercises, different things like that. Really good for the body. Okay, that's level one. Now let's go to level two. So now we're going to start with arms up. So elbows will actually be up toward the ceiling. And his arms are still bent in 90 degrees. He's still on his back, knees right over the hips. Now, he really wants to be focusing on where the breath is coming from in this rib cage and the belly area as he breathes in and as he breathes out. Okay. Now, opposite arm, opposite leg is going to go away from each other in that bent position and then come right back to that same position. Then opposite arm, opposite leg goes away. So that means the elbow and the knee are going to go away from each other and then they're going to come right back. Okay. But keeping it at this bent position in the arm and in the leg help to take not as big of levers away from that midline. So it's not going to be as much pressure and tension. It's still a lot of pressure and tension. So your goal is to keep that belly flat. You don't want to get up into like this doming type position. Next, the hardest one, I will say. So this is not where you need to go, especially if you're, if you have trouble keeping that belly kind of flat and using the breath pattern with it, you're going to come right back to that same position. Bent arms, bent legs. And now he's going to extend off, straight arm, straight leg, breathing in, breathing out, or breathing out as he reaches, breathing in as he comes back. Either one, he wants to keep his belly nice and flat so that he's utilizing obliques, rectus abdominis, pelvic floor, breath, diaphragm, everything kind of working there. Mm-hmm. How'd that feel?
Good. Starting to sweat. You're making it work.
You're making it work for sure. Okay, now we're going to go into a bridge type pattern. So we're going to think about that same arm, or opposite arm, opposite leg, same thing. So again, elbows bent right by the side, knees bent, feet on the floor. And what you're going to do as you go into a bridge, you're actually going to go into a single leg bridge and one elbow will push into the ground as you lift. So opposite arm, opposite leg reaches up. So, and then come back down. This is hard to explain. Okay. So he's going to push his right heel down and his right arm. Oh, this is not even. Oh, yeah. That's the right arm.
That's the right arm. You're doing great, baby.
My goodness. Right arm, right leg pushing down, right arm reaching overhead with the left arm, leg that comes back. So again, from that bridge, opposite leg comes up, opposite arm goes back, and then opposite heel pushing down with opposite elbow pushing down. Whew. I think you should just go to YouTube and watch it because it is hard to explain for me.
It's almost like you're laying on your back running.
Yes.
And I love it when you really hone in and focus on these things. A lot of people will do, like Jen was saying, do these exercises and say, oh, it's too easy. I need further progressions. Then 6 months down the road, they're backward. And it's like, okay, go to the easy progressions first. Go to the ones that you can really focus on all of those different cues, where you can really focus on all of those different activations, pressing back through one arm, bringing the other arm up, pressing down through one heel, bringing the other one up. You know, that's when you can really feel yourself put those pressures through that core and support through our core and our foundation the way we're supposed to while we get that movement of our arms and legs.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, it really just helps to repattern how that brain functions and coming back into those basic movement patterns to help to relieve pain, to make the body feel safe again. Because ultimately, especially with chronic pain, we want to make the body feel safe.
Absolutely. All right. So I've talked to you guys all about how my feet are so rigid and high arched and how Vivo barefoot shoes have really helped me find a little more flexibility in my feet and connect a little bit more into the ground around me. Now that it's summer too, one of my favorite things to do is get into my bare feet and get my feet in the sand because it really helps me feel all around my feet and the access I have to the different muscles and movements. Jen and I have been telling you guys about Vivo Barefoot.
We've had a code change, so make sure you use code TOB so that you get 15% off. That is TOB, like the Optimal Body Podcast.
All right, and heading into our next guest, we have Dr. Jennifer Hutton, aka Dr. J-Pop, and she is a pediatric doctor of physical therapy from Nashville, Tennessee, who works with kiddos from 1 to 18 of all different intellectual and physical abilities. As a Black woman, Dr. J-Pop knows what it's like to identify as different, and it has helped her in her quest to be an ally for children of all different abilities inside and outside of the clinic. Now she's educating others on how to be effective allies to Black and Indigenous people of color and furthering her desires to create a diverse and inclusive space that she calls Dr. J-Pop's neighborhood. So in this episode, we're going to dive a little bit into what Dr. J-Pop does as a pediatric therapist and then dive right into health and systemic disparities experienced of Black and people of color. We're so excited to share this with you. Let's dive in.
Welcoming to the podcast, we have one of my friends, Dr. Jen Hutton, who I got the opportunity to meet last year. Gosh, it's already been over a year, which is pretty crazy. But Jen is a pediatric therapist. And Jen, I just want you to give a brief background on what pediatric therapy is, how you got into it, and ultimately who you are.
Yeah, well, actually, my story kind of gives a background of what it is. But I got into pediatric physical therapy after my youngest cousin was diagnosed with cerebral palsy. The doctor pretty much told his mom, he's not going to walk, put him in a wheelchair. And she said, that's not going to happen. So I got to watch him go through regular physical therapy and occupational therapy, helping him learn how to become more independent, helping him with any equipment that he might need to be independent, from braces to walkers and gait trainers. And then anything with occupational therapy, teaching him how to dress himself and how to go to the bathroom and all of those things. And so that is where the passion was sparked to be in this field. But when it comes to peds, there is just a wide range of what you might see. I usually tell people I see anyone from the 2-year-old with cerebral palsy to the 19-year-old with an ACL tear, because depending on the clinic, you literally may just get slapped with the category peds and they send everything to you. So those that are congenital diagnoses, acquired diagnoses, and also any injuries that might happen, we see all of the above.
Can you quick go through what you mean by those who have acquired injuries or those who may have developmental things? Just like kind of explain what a few of those categories are of the people that you might end up working with?
Yeah, definitely. So congenital, it could be maybe there was trauma at birth and they do have, due to a lack of oxygen, they have been diagnosed with cerebral palsy. Kids with Down syndrome, kids with spina bifida, that could be categorized as congenital. And then you have acquired, which could be a traumatic brain injury, or maybe a stroke that happened when they were younger, as they were older, or maybe they have cancer, and they've lost some of their strengths and their abilities. So we work on those. Also orthopedic diagnoses. So anyone who breaks their leg or their arm and needs therapy. And then of course you have those childhood athletes as well, who have injuries and pains and aches that we take care of as well.
Yeah, I think it's cool that your first introduction was your cousin. I know for me personally, just going through PT school, one of the people who really inspired me in terms of just watching their journey as a student physical therapist was a man who had cerebral palsy, and just the ability of what he continued to live into rather than the disability of what he had. And I thought it was just, yeah, it's just so inspiring.
I love that, because I think we only know so much about the body. I think we know a lot, but we're learning new things every day. And so the label of what someone can't do, I love breaking down those walls. For a kid to say or have been told, you won't be able to do this or won't be able to do that, I'm ready to say, well, let's try it. So that's probably the most fun part of my job.
I'd say the one place that I kind of resonate with that is Special Olympics. I worked a lot with kind of through undergrad and grad school. And I think was one of my most incredible gifts to me was getting to work with Special Olympics for 10 years, because it taught me exactly that. Like, celebrating people for their abilities, not labeling their disabilities. It completely teaches you how to shift your language, which, by the way, you talk about individuals who have certain, diagnoses and stuff very well. I love how you like always form your language about the person and not about the diagnosis. I think that's really valuable for providers to learn. And it's a really like small nuance, but you do it very well. And you can just tell that. And I appreciate someone who does that, especially in like a pediatric world. That's super important. And in talking about that, like, I know people or parents or families can be very sensitive about their kid and their child and what they need, and they might have thoughts about what their kid needs. How do you work with kids and their parents to help communicate what a kid might actually need?
The parent has to understand that they are a part of the team. We're all on a team, and our goal is to help this child be as independent and enjoy their life to the fullest. So I'm frequently bringing in the parent in on the things that I'm doing during the session and doing whatever I can to provide them with resources so that they can feel confident working on things at home. So I probably am a lot closer to a lot of my parents than some, but most of them have my cell phone number. I will do video chats if they maybe need, you know, have questions or need help with something. I talk to school therapists. I talk to school teachers. I email them just to make sure that there is communication with the whole team. And I think that's what's missing in a lot of pediatric therapy is you think that they're just there in the clinic and that's what they should be doing, getting the treatment there. But we should be extending arms to the parents, to all of those in that kid's community so that we can all be on the same page.
Oh my God. I think that's what's missing in healthcare in general. I think the way you string it together is so beautiful in order to have this open dialogue and actually be able to treat a human. You know, we always want to put people in boxes and labels and certain treatments, but to have it mix and actually see the person as a whole in every aspect of their life is so incredibly important. So that's incredible, Jen.
I love it. I think it's funny. Before my cousin said I wanted to be a physician, because my father is a physician, and he said, "I think you could do it. I don't think you'd be happy." And I was like, "Why not?" He said, "I think that you would hate that you couldn't spend as much time as you wanted to with your patients." And he was correct. When I got out into the field and was given only 30 minutes for sessions, I was like, this is not going to work for me. So I had to look for a space that allowed me to truly be who I was and give what I wanted to my patients.
I mean, we could talk about pediatrics a lot more. And I think talking about neurodevelopment and the importance of it and what to start to look for is important and possibly another conversation that we're going to dive into even more on another podcast. Mm-hmm.
I think something that really ties into what we're going to dive into is just health in general.
Yeah.
And that you're an expert in health, you know, we're experts in health and how there are so many health disparities. I mean, yes. In our country, yeah. Between different groups of people, whether it's race, socioeconomic status, so many different things that comes with, you know, different disparities in health. And that really reflects kind of this stuff we're going through as a country, you know, with, yes. Our Black Lives Matter movement coming out and how we're having so many people who are openly undergoing suppression, and we're seeing people getting killed and murdered by police forces. And so with all of this going on, we're just wondering, you as a provider, you who've been doing the work in this area as well, one, what does that mean to be doing work in this area and to be growing awareness of what's going on in our world and all the disparities we're seeing? And yeah, anything else you just kind of want to talk about what's going on right now and what you would want this audience to hear?
Well, I think that my big push, I did that webinar, and my big push was honestly, let's go back to the history. And the reason I wanted to do that was because I feel like we have all of these cultural competency and diversity seminars trying to teach people how to be more aware in the present. But you can really form a picture if you look at the past. You can understand how a system was built and why it's working the way that it is. People say that it's broken. The healthcare system is not broken. It's broken for people, but it's working the way that it was built to work. So if I can show you that at the beginning, then say, hey, after 340 years of slavery and then 80 something years of segregation, we really haven't been on this side very long. So to see everything that has happened really helps you form the idea around racial trauma and the issues that people are facing, the anger that they're feeling, the anxiety, the depression, having to face these issues over and over and over again in system after system, it wears on your body. So it's no wonder that we have these disparities, because we have certain percentages of our population who are always on guard. They are always stressed about what's going to happen every minute. When they walk out of the door, they don't know if they're going to come back. So that is going to take a toll on your physical therapy session or your occupational therapy session or your massage therapy session, because this is what they're facing when they walk in your door and when they leave your door. And if you can have that framework around creating their programs and creating what they need, then you will benefit them so much more. And I think we have a gold mine in healthcare that we're not using to help people of color. And that's really what I want to educate people on.
Mm. So where do we start with that in terms of having this gold mine and being able to provide for people? Is it just having that awareness when someone walks into the door of having that underlying stress that's already a part of the problem? And are we playing that into the equation through the assumption? Or how else can we kind of play into how do we make it better?
So I think not assuming that every person, because we clearly just had a discussion before we recorded about an incident that I probably would not have said something that someone of color did, that just shows you every Black experience is different, every Filipino experience is different, everybody's experience is different. So I can't assume that everybody's facing racial trauma every minute of the day. But I can be more aware that if they do have high blood pressure, if they are facing obesity, if they are having healthcare challenges, this could play a role into it. So I've talked to a lot of yoga instructors and massage therapists and said, you guys could teach them ways to cope during your sessions that they could at least not maybe know that it's linked to your idea of racial trauma or your awareness of racial trauma, but that you're giving them a tool that will help them along the way. So I think not trying to do a one size fits all, but keeping that in the back of your mind, because for every session, you're still going to have to personalize it for that person. You're still going to have to take in what that person is facing. But if you're aware of it and you're listening to what they're saying and listening to their needs and they feel comfortable that you are an ally in that space, I think that you'll operate from a place of conviction and everything will be authentic.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And early on, and as somebody, you know, personally, I'm a white male and I'm from rural Minnesota and I grew up in a place mm-hmm. that is not very diverse. And, mm-hmm. you know, I was very blessed that I had parents that wanted me to see a lot and learn about humans and humanity and everything. But I know that there are a lot of people, especially from places like where I grew up or my hometown, that just don't have that experience and almost get... Yes. a little uncomfortable in those situations. And this is when I learned about something called microaggressions, you know, or microaggressors. And again, as somebody who may not have a lot of, you know, experience in racial situations, you can throw out a lot of microaggressors and not know what you're doing or not know it, right? And again, this is one thing we're talking about right now is that the ignorance to it right now isn't as much of the excuse anymore as, you know, as long as we're open to learning about those things. So how can somebody go and start to learn about their lack of knowledge of something? Or where would you recommend somebody who really is not comfortable, you know, in this kind of area talking about diversity or talking about racial disparities, where can they start going to maybe learn about how to ask the right questions and how to ask somebody these things when they just don't know?
So are you meaning ask themselves the questions, like self-interrogation, or?
Yeah, want to learn more, but might not know how to ask these questions or learn about, you know, microaggressions they may be making.
Yeah, yes. So I think there are just specific questions that you have to ask yourself that at least gives you a barometer of where you are. So if you are white, I would say, what does it mean to be white in America? Especially right now, like when you look around, what does it mean? What does it feel like to be white in America? What were you taught about people of color? Can you recall incidences of racism that you knew something was wrong, but you didn't know what to say? What are your initial thoughts of Black Lives Matter? What are your thoughts when a Black person walks into your clinic, or someone who's on Medicaid walks into your clinic? Because asking yourself those questions and truly answering them will expose some of those implicit biases, those unconscious thoughts that you have developed. And if you want to go further, I say, what were you taught in your home? Like, what are some of the things that you heard in your home? What are some of the things that you heard your friends say that you probably didn't think about it at the time, but now you see they helped you form the ideas that you have now? And I think that lets you know where you are. For the profession, I think you need to look at your surroundings, your profession, your clinics, your settings, your community, your governing bodies, and see what does the cultural makeup look like. Have there been times maybe in the clinic where a person of color felt uncomfortable and you didn't understand why, or you brushed it off? Those are the self-interrogation and professional interrogation questions I feel like you could start to ask yourself just to see where you are. And then from there, you work on it. If you can do it and work on your own mindset and talk to people around you, that's awesome. If you can't, we have plenty of communities online now that are really diving in and doing this work. So I think if you can just get connected to people that are doing the same work, it will be extremely helpful.
Now, what are examples of microaggressions? Like, I know Dom mentioned it, and you're kind of tapping on what I believe are probably some good examples, but can you really define it for people so that they can understand it right now?
Yeah. So the definition of microaggressions is like brief, verbal, behavioral, environmental communications that usually happen unintentionally that make the environment hostile or send negative messages to the person that is receiving them. So an example of that would be if someone said to you, "Hey, I feel like this person has an issue because of this color of my skin," and you brushed it off and said, "No, it's probably not that. They're really nice usually. So I don't think that's what it is." Or, you know, someone saying to me, "You're really articulate for a Black woman," or "Your hair is really pretty," or for a Black woman. Like those are microaggressions, because that tells me you have an initial thought in your head that's unconscious to you or subconscious to you, but it's showing out in how you're treating me. So those are some examples of microaggressions.
Yes. And have you seen these show up in healthcare, like around where you've been? Have you had experiences with people, whether it's patients, whether it's in school, whether it's in the profession? Like, What have been your experiences?
I've had them in the clinic and I've had them in our professional space. One I actually talked about a couple weeks ago was actually I switched patients with a therapist because some stuff happened scheduling wise. And it was very apparent that the family was not interested in me treating that child. And the reason that I knew it was an issue with me was because I had seen them interact with other therapists. And there was never an issue until it was my turn. And so that was a microaggression that I felt, but actually had to just work through because I had to treat the child. And it's something that I would say I've prepared myself. I prep myself each time. There is a possibility that this patient or this family won't want to see you. How are you going to get past it? And to me, it sounds arrogant, but I usually say, look, I'm here for the child. They're going to love me by the end of the session when they realize that. So that's how I've learned how to cope in the clinic. But then I also had an incident at CSM in 2018, I think it was.
Can you say what CSM is real quick for people who don't know?
Combined sections meeting for the APTA or American Physical Therapy Association. They do it once a year. It's really big. They have a lot of different sessions and continuing education that you can get. But there's also an exhibit hall that you can come and play with different equipment and learn about different programs. And I went in to see a specific piece of equipment with a couple friends, and there were different groups that wanted to see it. And the girl finished the presentation, and I went to reach for the equipment and she took it out of my hand and went to the group next to me. And I have been blessed to have allies around me my whole life. And my ally that was with me said, "Whoa, what the hell was that? Like, did that just happen?" And so it was very aware that there was a reason she skipped me. But when she was called out, it was like deer in the headlights look. And so in that moment, I felt like, you know, I didn't expect it in this space, but I shouldn't be surprised. And I knew that I probably would have to always have my guard up again in this space, which was disheartening because you're there as a physical therapist and you have to be reminded that your skin color is an issue. So those are just some of those microaggressions that I've faced as a professional.
Wow. That is, I mean, it's just so difficult to hear that. And I don't think that's where people understand that it happens in this day and age. And that's why I think, like, I thank you for being able to be open and talk about it, because people need to hear it. It's just, it's something that it's like, oh, well, that happened so long ago. Slavery was so long ago. So it's not a problem anymore, you know? And I think understanding and having this awareness is just so important.
Yeah. extremely important, which is why I feel moved to educate more, because I'm like, I feel like being able to tell my stories and give you my experience will help you be more aware and actually listen to more people that come into this field, because there are a lot of voices with a lot of stories like mine in our profession. And I feel like those need to be heard so we can see what we're really dealing with.
And I love you talking about these microaggressions and how socially they're still very prevalent and people are experiencing them daily. And I think one of the major issues as well is that institutionally, we have written in all these microaggressions. And one of the things that I heard of the first time is like, they just handed me a medical intake form and they said, count how many microaggressions there are on this form for a, you know, a single female minority woman who, you know, all the things that you might not know reading through that intake form. And it just makes you feel like, wow, do they not even think I'm a real person because my, my race or my gender isn't on here? You know, I don't know my medical history. All these questions you're asking about are things unfamiliar to me. And immediately they walk into that clinic and say, oh my gosh, like they're questioning themselves. They're more scared. They're more stressed just walking into that room now. And so I don't know if you want to speak a little bit into some now how we've institutionalized this process from, you know, slavery to the social microaggressions you're still, you know, seeing today. How have we institutionalized some of this stuff?
Well, I think it really goes back to the history. And if you even look at the beginning of where everything started for not just our country, but all of the systems in place, there was always a belief that white was superior and that any other race, any immigrants that came in were inferior to white people. So if you build a system with that ideology in place, naturally everything is going to trend to the support of the person who you think is superior. So you see that in healthcare, you saw it through separating of wards for a colored ward and a white people's ward. And you had healthcare professionals who could opt out of treating Black people. You had patients that were sent to be treated at county hospitals or medical schools because they weren't allowed to be treated in the white hospitals. And then from there on out, it's everything is with the white perspective. If those are the people creating the laws, creating the bills, creating the intake forms and the system of processes that you go through in your different places of work, if those are the only voices that are at the forefront creating these things, then you're not going to have a diverse view. So that's why that intake form looks like that, because there was only white people there that were creating it, likely. And if you were able to invite more voices onto the panel, and this isn't just people of color, this is LGBTQ plus as well. Like there are many questions on a lot of these forms and a lot of these intakes that it's like, whew, we weren't thinking about a large percentage of people. And I think it's important for us to invite more people into these rooms where these things are being created, where these things are being changed, so that we can truly have a perspective that allows everybody to feel seen and feel heard. So I think right now it's like, look at where we started. How do we flip it? Put more people in the room.
Yeah. Which means vote.
Vote. Please vote. And please look. And really, I say this not just, I try to not make it political in terms of look at the administrations, because I feel like we've had these issues for hundreds of years. But look at what you're voting for on all fronts, your local front, state front, nation front, organizations that you are in, your APTA, whatever your organization is, look at the governing bodies. Who are you voting? Are you voting? Are you actually looking at who's in charge? Because that will hold everybody in power accountable to the changes that we want to see.
Yeah, this is, I mean, it's just so incredibly important. And I'll be honest, like I used to be the person who's like, oh, I don't want to talk about politics. Let's talk about something else. I don't want to learn. I don't want to do like, but it's just like I'm not taking responsibility for myself and for my community, my society, but my beliefs. And, you know, to recognize that in myself and to acknowledge that in myself, it's something where I have had to step up for sure.
And it's, if it doesn't affect you, then it's hard to see it every day.
Yeah.
And I think that's the one thing I want. It's like, if you're not dealing with these daily issues, I understand why it wasn't at the forefront. I am just happy that more people are choosing to be aware and educate themselves now.
So I do want to just kind of touch on, because I know I've heard, and I think a lot of us have heard, you know, the feedback where it's just like it, but that was so long ago and it just doesn't matter anymore. So either you're not working hard enough or you're being lazy, but you can't blame the system. What do you kind of, how do you respond in these situations?
It depends on the person, because to me, that is a cry saying you haven't done the work. Because if you simply know the history of where we came from and the fact that we have really changed nothing, we've just creatively morphed it into different faces, then it's easy to say, you know, oh, it's all done. Slavery was, you know, hundreds of years ago, and segregation was 50 years ago. So we're good. We've done well, but the effects of all of it are still in place. And so my fight back is usually, okay, so what work, what resources have you read? What books have you read that have led you to this conclusion? And that to me shows me whether I should waste my energy on the discussion, because it will let you know I'm not complaining because I don't have choices. I'm celebrating the choices that I have had. I'm celebrating the achievements that I've had, but I also recognize that everybody doesn't have the same experience, and there's a reason why. And so it's my duty, even if I have success, to go back and see how I can help those people who don't have the same leg up that I have, and change the systems that have been put in place that are keeping them from that. So my response would be, everybody didn't have bootstraps to pull up. People say that all the time. I'll pull it up by your bootstraps. I worked, and I did, and I worked hard. But if you can acknowledge that you were given privilege just by the color of your skin in any space that you are, if you can acknowledge that and accept it, then you can understand why we still have the issues we have today and why it still is a very big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes to so many of those things. And I think that, kind of like you said, if people are very, very, you know, kind of immediately in opposition to, like, when you bring up Black Lives Matter, or if you say, oh, this is a systemic thing and it's been around since racism, then they just haven't, like you said, done the work to realize it's pretty clear that the health disparities, the police brutality, all of the systemic issues we see for Black and brown people are just baked into the system, and it's due to the legislation and the policies that we've created from the beginning. So I know that with lots of things going on now, you're doing a lot of work. There's this term that's coming out a lot now called anti-racism. What does that mean? And how do we join that movement? And how do we support?
So to be an anti-racist is to actively see the issues that are going on in our country and do the work to help dismantle those systems that have created the ideas that are still present today. So the first thing I'd say is be aware of what that is in yourself. Like, do you truly feel that what you've seen is wrong? Do you feel convicted to do the work? Because if you don't, then it's going to come across when you actually try to show up as an ally. I always say that your blind spots as an ally will make you ineffective. So you have to figure those out in yourself. And then see what space you can have an impact in. So a lot of people have said, oh, I'm in an all-white community. Most of my town is white. I really don't know how to do the work. Well, there's always the online community. There are all sorts of Black associations that you could partner with to just be in those spaces. I would say, don't just go looking for Black people or people of color to educate you, but ingratiate yourself to those communities so that you can actually have those connections. And having those authentic connections will actually help you see the work that needs to be done. It's not supposed to be comfortable work, but I don't want people to feel like they have to do it all. You don't have to sign the petitions, do the protests, donate to all the things, do this, do that. No, you need to pick the things that your energy will truly serve, even if they're uncomfortable, and you need to just go to work in that lane.
So true. Is your webinar still available?
It is. It is available on Crowdcast. The replay is. I'm doing another one for Imbodia on July the 14th. I think that's actually next Tuesday. So if people are interested in seeing it live, that is an option. But yes, also the replay is available.
And where could people find that?
You can find that on my website, actually, www.drjpop.com. And if you're on Instagram, you can click the link in my bio, and the link to all of those things are available.
Perfect. Which, of course, we will have linked up in the show notes. Mm-hmm. Definitely is go follow J-Pop just to see everything that she's up to. I think it's incredibly just amazing of you to be stepping up and be willing to educate, because I know how exhausting that could be. But the fact that you're stepping up in healthcare professionals and helping and showing how we can support and create this health system that doesn't have as much disparity, that is inclusive to all, and that can truly help and make change, I think is so incredible. So I really commend you for the work that you're doing. I understand how exhausting it can be. I don't understand, but I imagine how exhausting it can be. And I just, you know, we're very grateful to have you. And I we're for sure going to have you back in order to dive into all the goodies and the knowledge that you have in your brain.
Well, thank you so much for having me, but I would absolutely love to come back.
Of course. Any last words of where people, you know, need to see more of what you have to offer, or where they can get in contact with you?
So all social media spaces, Instagram, Dr.jpop, Twitter, Dr.jpop, Facebook, Dr. J-Pop. You are always welcome to connect with me on those spaces. If you want to sign up for my email list, which all of the action steps for that are in the link in my bio, on Instagram, you can do that, because that's where I'm updating people more frequently about what I will be doing next, because I am looking into starting a community for allies to connect with each other, to have resources, to talk to each other, bounce ideas off of each other, because I feel like this is something you need to do in a group. It's very hard to do by yourself if you haven't connected to someone. So that is what is next on the horizon.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. And I think that's a group that will continue to grow and grow. And we will have to have you on again in the future to see how things are going.
Yes, I would love it.
All right. Thanks, Jen. We'll talk soon.
Thank you so much for listening to us on the Optimal Body Podcast, where we're going to continue to bring you the PT pearls and guests that will help you find your optimal body. Now, head over to wherever you listen to this and leave us an honest review, and head to docgenfit.com/podcast, where you can find all the show notes.
Don't forget that we're going to give away a free month to someone who subscribes, leaves us an awesome review, and lets us know what they want to review on the next PT Pearl. So we'll be choosing that once a week to get into a free month of the